somehow at the end of the 90s, early 2000s, the heist genre got mashed up with the erotic thriller.
Interesting.
And we got some very sexy heist movies. Because, I mean, what? Nobody remembers what happened in Entrapment. The only thing Entrapment is known for is Catherine Zeta-Jones in a cat suit going through the lasers. I mean,
that's... Yeah, I watched the trailer for that right before we recorded, and I was like, I've seen that movie because Sean Connery and Catherine Zeta-Jones. And then, I saw the clips, and I was like, yeah, I've seen that movie.
Episode of Nation. My name is Brandon Sparks.
And I'm Ben Gertz.
And I'm Thomas Horton.
And with each new episode of Nation, we delve into a specific subgenre of film, its history, the tropes of the genre, and specific examples. And at the end of each episode that we do now, Thomas and myself, we pitch Ben on what films we think he should watch, because Ben's a very busy person and he needs to, we need to curate his film watching.
Yeah, so it's not necessary. We're continuing to evolve, but I think these pitches are not necessarily like the best of the genre, because we'll talk about them in the episode, but it's just ones that might have been overlooked.
Yeah.
Ones that aren't as well known, or just ones that Ben hasn't seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this will be interesting to the listener, because I choose a winner and everybody loves a competition.
And so, on today's episode, we're going to talk about heist movies. And when we started this new format, this is one I've been excited for ever since. And it's heist movies and caper movies. And I want to delve into that.
Oh, real quick. One thing.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Because I like to encourage people to reach out to us when an episode comes out. If we miss a movie in our list that you think should be included within a genre, definitely send that along to us. But I have a correction I have to make. I was reached out to by a listener as soon as our Screwball Comedy episode dropped, in that I... wrongly summarized How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, and I just want to apologize and go back and state that Matthew McConaughey was not a reporter in that film. Kate Hudson was a reporter. Matthew McConaughey was an ad exec trying to land a big diamond company, and the owner of the diamond company told him that in order to be their ad exec, you had to be able to make someone fall in love with you. So he was doing it all for a job, and that's my correction. There you go.
That's how we lose listeners.
My bad.
No, it's okay. Our topic for today, the subgenre is heist films, and also known as caper films. And capers are kind of the more comedic versions of certain heist films. But the heist film, when looking at it, that I want to talk about, we're kind of going to go through, like, because there's really different eras of the heist film that essentially start in the beginning of film in 1903 with The Great Train Robbery. And The Great Train Robbery was directed... It's a Western film, but it's a heist film. They're robbing a train for, I think, gold is what it is.
This is streaming on YouTube for listeners that want to join in.
Yeah, it's about 12 minutes.
Yeah.
But it was directed by Edwin S. Porter, who was considered one of the early filmmakers of that era. And the film was so crazy about watching early films like this. Even though they're short, they're 5-10 minutes, you're seeing these directors really explore the medium of film. Mm-hmm. And so, like with Great Train Robbery, it's one of the earliest examples of cross-cutting, like showing two things happening at the same time in different locations.
Right. To build tension.
Which
we take for granted now. Totally take for granted.
But yeah, so Great Train Robbery, it's a fun watch. It was later remade, I think, a couple times throughout the century. But yeah,
I just know the Sean Connery one, which is solid. That's a good Sean Connery and Donald Sutherland.
And it was directed by Michael Crichton.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah, he wrote it too.
And that's the guy who gave us Westworld and wrote Jurassic Park and ER and all that. So the heist genre has basically been a part of cinema since the early 1900s, and it has evolved over time. And in the 30s and 40s is essentially how the heist genre kind of breaks off from the gangster genre and the film noir genre.
Mm-hmm.
And it's coming at a time in the 40s and 30s when people like John Dillinger and these bank robbers actually exist in the real world. And the films are portraying characters that are similar to that. We got a clip that I want to let you guys watch and listen to, and just kind of showcase the early era of the heist genre, and it's a movie called High Sierra that stars Humphrey Bogart and kind of his breakout role. Like, he had not been a lead, I think, before High Sierra, and he begged the director, Raoul Walsh, to cast him. And Raoul Walsh also directed White Heat, which is also a big film that fits into this genre in the 40s. In this scene, Bogart is meeting with the people who are going to help him with the heist, and he's just been released from prison. And there's a character that he's found out. He talks too much and tells people, like, he reveals too much information. And Bogart is basically going to threaten him in some way within this scene.
Like, Mike gave me the machine gun. Know how to work it? Brad doesn't, and neither does Babe.
And that's a good one, that is.
What's so funny?
Does he know how to work it?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that gun reminds me of one time 9 or 10 years ago. He was getting ready to do a job back in Iowa when one of the guys got the shakes. Well, pretty soon we found out that this guy with the shakes had talked too much, and a bunch of coppers are waiting for us down at the bank. So we don't say nothing. Lefty Jackson goes out and gets his gun. Comes back and sits down and holds it across his knee. The guy with the shakes is sitting right across the room from him. Pretty soon, Lefty just touched the trigger a little, and the gun went like that. The rat fell out of his chair dead, and we drove off and left him there. Yeah, the gun just went.
Well, I guess I ought to be getting back. I have to go on duty at 8:30.
What's your stunt? You stick right to the whole job, don't you?
Oh, sure. I stand behind the desk and act like I'm scared. When you fellows get through, I telephone the police.
We don't want no slip-ups, Mendoza.
Boys and girls, I got the idea that our boyfriend here is no cream puff. How'd you like the little bedtime story about the gun that went? Did you get the idea?
Do you suppose he meant it that way?
Try talking and find out.
Wow.
I think that's a great piece of writing for that. Like, just how he can essentially tell a story, Bogart can, to make the character know exactly what will happen if he says something.
Yeah, that's great.
And for those that are hearing it, because there's kind of silent parts that are happening in that when you hear it, you're getting actually cutting back and forth between everyone in the room as they're listening to this conversation and everyone's reaction, because they all know exactly what Bogart is saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, it's going to be, I'm really excited. Part of the reason I'm really excited about this episode is kind of track the evolution of this genre in particular. But you can still kind of see the gangster genre and the heist genre at this point are both still pretty rooted in noir and still pretty serious. Like, that's the stakes are pretty high. You're still pretty far from the caper films at this point.
Yeah.
And as far as the gangster genre goes, you're still very far from Scarface at this point.
Yeah.
You know, the De Palma Scarface.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too, though, that you could imagine that scene in a film today. I mean, you know, they've got kind of goofy accents, I guess, if you just showed up, right? But that, the writing in that, and the way that he's indirectly threatening, I mean, that happens. That's a staple of the genre for sure.
So John Huston, who directed movies like The Maltese Falcon, which also starred Humphrey Bogart, and so John Huston was kind of known for, he was an avid reader. And so everyone talked about how he was one of the best writers who could give a faithful adaptation to a book. And so he adapted numerous books that everyone thought were unadaptable for the time period. Mm-hmm. So High Sierra was in 1941, and it was based on a book by W.R. Burnett. And Huston loved Burnett's writing, and they had made a bunch of movies from Burnett's books. And like, if you look at his filmography, Burnett ended up writing a bunch of books, including Little Caesar, and he wrote the script for Little Caesar and the script for Scarface, the 1930s version. And so he was very big in the gangster era, and Huston really wanted to adapt one of Burnett's books, but because he felt like films hadn't really captured this author's style and voice. And so Huston came in and pretty much wanted to write a movie for that, and then he met Bogart, and that led to a big collaboration throughout their entire careers. But why I bring up Houston is because I feel like where the heist movie started to change, where it goes off from being a gangster movie with the heist to where it becomes an actual heist movie, is in 1950s Asphalt Jungle. And that's kind of where I think the genre really finds its footing, because it's essentially, that's their whole purpose, is they're going to steal jewels from a jewelry store or something, or I think it's a museum actually. And I tried to get a clip, but the problem with that movie is that everything's so visual that it really wouldn't help you listeners of like actually see how great the film is and what it's doing.
Yeah,
because it was so hard to, because I was trying to find scenes and it was just kind of just certain dialogue scenes that you kind of didn't get the essence of what was happening in the film.
Well, that's something we'll talk about as we start breaking out into the different genres, but that's an aspect that becomes very popular in the French heist cinema, is you have at least, I'm not going to pronounce this correctly, but Les Cercles Rouges.
Les Cercles Rouges, yeah.
Which is like an extended, what is it, like 20-minute completely silent heist sequence, and Rafifi is also like super, you know, they have to be quiet plot wise.
Yeah, so. And Rafifi, that was this movie there, because I watched a couple of the behind the scenes or special features on the Criterion for Asphalt Jungle, and one of the historians talks about how he basically, you can draw a direct line from Asphalt Jungle to Rafifi. And so Asphalt Jungle is kind of the big influencer for that French style of filmmaking in the 50s. Mm-hmm. Where, because in the same thing in Asphalt Jungle, there's a scene in the middle where it's pretty much just a silent scene of them breaking into the place and robbing it. I haven't watched as much French stuff. I know Rafifi I've seen, which I think is a masterpiece. And then you start getting into the French New Wave stuff as well, which you get Band of Outsiders, which is what our Letterboxd list is called, by the way. And that was Jean-Luc Godard film. It was in the 50s or was it in the 60s?
I think it was 60s.
60s?
Yeah.
And that was like, it was kind of these like movie, because the thing about French New Wave, because we've brought this up before, the actor or the creators and the writers and directors were very in love with American pop culture and movie culture. And so Band of Outsiders is, it's very apparent that these guys are all like movie fanatics, and especially heist films. And they essentially decide to become robbers kind of because of it. And it's a film that influenced a lot of other directors. I think even Tarantino named his production company from the film in the 90s and everything. So we're getting the French New Wave or French films, and we've gone from gangster bank robbers into just straight heist films in the 50s and the French films.
Well, and something I was really excited about this episode for sure, is because I think more than any other subgenre we've done so far, it's really easy to point to where this subgenre fits into many other genres. And so we were talking about how it came up kind of through the gangster genre and continues to be made, you know, to this day within that genre. But you've also got a lot of really great ones, a lot of really great heist movies within the Western genre. You've got a lot of really great spy movies that follow the format of a heist movie. And that's something Brandon and I kind of saw when we started breaking this list down, is how, you know, you've got your standard heist movie, but then you've got your heist movie that falls into so many other categories as well. And everyone knows kind of the storyline and how the story is going to go, but in all these different settings with all these different kind of characters.
Yeah, it's like, so you start, and then also too, you start breaking down to certain parts of the world. So you get the French stuff, and then you get the British heist films, which are more like where the idea of a caper comes into it, where it's these British comedies where these comedic kind of really crazy characters are robbing something, or they're pulling off a heist. And the big example would be the Lady Killers with Alec Guinness and Peter Sellers. And that was in, let me get the year. I just watched this for the first time, and it's a funny film, and you can see why. It was later remade in 2004 by the Coen brothers. And the Coens are one of those one of the few filmmakers where they look to older films like this and they bring it out in a a lot of their later, a lot of their films and everything. There's a few times where I'm watching some heist films for this episode, and you just kind of go, oh, that's kind of a similar plot to this Coen Brothers movie, or they've remade it, or they're very, very much students of cinema, mm-hmm. and it comes out in their work. And so they remade Lady Killers, another movie, which is in the 70s and more grittier, is Charlie Varick with Walter Matthau, and it's kind of like a heist kind of gone wrong, but it's a very similar plot to No Country for Old Men. And so it's very, a lot of their stuff there, you can see their influences when you start getting into heist films. But Lady Killers was a black comedy in 1955 by Alexander McKendrick and the Ealing Studios in England, and they released, and they were kind of this big British company or a studio system or a studio that was happening at that time. I want to delve into more stuff after watching Lady Killers because it was just really funny, really beautiful, like lush looking films.
Yeah, and I think that led directly into the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, where you had this idea that things, it could be stylish, it could be fun, it could have some laughs, some quips. You know, How to Steal a Million is one that really sticks out to me with Audrey Hepburn. Pink Panther, even, a lot of people forget that the original Pink Panther isn't like an out and out farce. It's a heist movie that just happens to have Peter Sellers in it. And even Ocean's 11 was trying to be that. They didn't pull it off, the original Ocean's 11, which I think we'll talk about a little bit more when we get into the remake. But yeah, when you think back on like the 60s and heist movies in the 60s, I think you really feel that influence of the British caper, making it a lot more light and more fun, and the idea that you can, you know, really root for these people, you know, even if they're technically bad, you know, you can just go all in on wanting them to be able to pull off this heist.
Yeah, I mean, even with, I mean, you're getting into, say, 60s into the 70s with the early Redford stuff with The Sting, and with the Hot Rockets, another good one that he did where he's a jewel thief. But yeah, so you're getting that into the 70s or 60s and 70s where you're getting this caper genre that is focused more on comedy than the dramatic moments in the films.
Mm-hmm. Which, just real quick, it was something kind of interesting and this is the way when you start looking at these subgenres, you can see these differences. While the heist genre in itself is becoming lighter and more fun, it's mm-hmm. kind of interesting that this is also when the Western, what is widely considered the death of the Western genre, even though we still make Westerns, this is the death of the, you know, the great Westerns. And when the death of the Western came, the Western kind of went in the opposite direction. Everyone was starting to go, oh, the Westerns are dying out. And these auteurs, these really great directors, were going, well, before it dies off, I want to put my spin on a really dark version of the Western. Mm-hmm. And that's where you get something like the Wild Bunch from, is the death of the Wild West, the death of the cowboys, all these aging cowboys who are going out on one last heist. And even I don't think you can classify Butch Cassidy as a dark Western, but I think we all know how that ends. And it's you know, a lot of the Western genre in the 70s where, you know, the West is getting too small for us. There's more cops than there are robbers at this point, and we just got to make one last heist and we can get away scot clean, and that never works out.
Yeah, it's like the famous 70s film Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah, we just need money and a plan.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's, yeah, with the Western, it's becoming aware that time is catching up with them, and mm-hmm. it's not as wide open as it has been.
But it's really interesting as you know, the heist genre as an independent mm-hmm. genre is getting more slick and more fun. The Western genre is dying off, and so you're getting these Western heists that are more gritty and darker.
And you're beginning to see people like Redford and Newman start their careers from some of these films. So you're going from this era of caper, because the caper stuff is really big in the 60s with you're talking about How to Steal a Million and a couple other.
Do you want to, just for the sake of people listening like myself, parse out the difference between caper and heist, right? Because I was reading a little bit about it, and I don't know that I could explain it to a random person on the street.
Yeah. And Tom would jump in too, because I always see a caper as kind of a more comedic approach to it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a lighthearted view of stealing something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's always called the full term is a crime caper, and so I always think of a caper as being more focused on having a good time than the actual heist in itself. My ideal caper, and we're skipping ahead in the timeline a little bit, but my ideal caper is A Fish Called Wanda. I love that movie. I've seen that movie countless times, and I literally can't count the amount of times I've seen it, and I still couldn't really tell you exactly what the crime is in that movie, like exactly what they're doing. I know there's a key and the fish has the key and all that stuff, mm-hmm. but it's about the process and the characters and all that kind of mm-hmm. stuff. And the heist in itself isn't as important.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point, because this even goes back to some of the stuff we talked about. Like, when I talked about The Thin Man and we did Screwball Comedy, where that's a detective story. Someone's been murdered, but it's still a comedy. Like, you're more invested in the characters and their personalities and what their chemistry is and what they're doing than what the actual murder plot or what the actual crime is.
Right.
It's about
something like The Sting, I wouldn't call a caper, because it is a lot of fun and there's comedic elements to it and you like all the characters. But when you think back on The Sting, you think about the plan that they're pulling off and how complicated it was and all the different, all the different things that were in play.
Right. Same Soderbergh's Ocean's 11 would be the same, where it's like, it's fun, but it is about the heist. The heist is what you remember. Yeah. It just happens to have great characters.
The Mirage,
along
the Bellagio, and the MGM Grand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Remember exactly which casinos they're robbing.
And this is jumping really far ahead, but with that film, I want to talk, they pick three real casinos, which I think is a big point to make, because usually you would have them go like, oh, it's these three fake casinos and shoot mm-hmm. elsewhere. They pick three legit casinos that kind of, if you've been to Vegas, you know. So backtrack. We're talking the difference between caper and heist. I also want to bring up the fact, the difference between a con movie and a heist film.
Yeah.
Because this was something that I started delving into when going through this, because there was certain films that were on this list originally that I'm like, oh, those are heist films or whatever, or even like certain lists list them as heist films online. And then when I start delving into them, no, this is a con movie, and certain heist films will have cons to it, like The Sting. The Sting mm-hmm. is essentially a big con.
Yeah, they're all con men. It's a team of con men.
I think what I realized, the difference between how a heist movie can be, it's like the heist movie can be a con film, but a con film isn't always a heist film. And what I've, the point that I think that really helped me understand this was the point of view of point of view of the story. Who are you following within the story? Mm-hmm. Are you following the con man, or are you following the person who's being conned? Because there was a certain movie I watched where, I don't want to say a name because it kind of spoils the film at the end, but you're following this certain character throughout and you think they're involved and like helping out with the con going down. And then you find out they're being conned the entire time. So if you're from the perspective of the con who's planning it all and trying to, say, rob this person of something, then you can consider that a heist film. But if you're switching from the person who's being conned, it's not that anymore. Does that make sense? Because it's a very weird distinction that I kind of, and maybe I'm wrong.
Well, and you're saying too, though, that con movies can not be about a heist. You could be conning someone over some other thing.
Yeah, but heist films, like say Ocean's 11, which, I mean, we're gonna say a lot, it's Ocean's 11 is kind of just a bunch of cons put together, kind of like The Sing, mm-hmm. where you have a Bernie Mac playing a blackjack dealer who's hiding his real identity to Andy Garcia's character. Why am I blanking? To the people at Bellagio or whatever. Yeah. And that's a con. Or Casey Affleck and Scott Conn, like, putting balloons in front of the camera and like having an argument together because they're trying to get someone into a back room or whatever. There's cons to it all. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's a difference. Like Matchstick Men, I looked at, and that's essentially a con movie and not a heist film.
Yeah.
So that's why it's not on the list. Sadly, it's a great film. You should watch it.
Snap back on Twitter though if you disagree with Brandon's parsing of the language.
Yeah, because it's all subjective. Like, I mean, you might consider House of Games or Matchstick Men a heist film. All of them have their own tropes to it. That's the thing, is that you start finding your own tropes, and with heist films especially, you're gonna have things where it's like you have the sequence of them getting together and then building the team if it's a team heist film.
Oh yeah, that's the best part. That's the best part.
Yeah.
Building the team. Love it.
And so yeah. Or there's always a conflict where something happens at the midpoint, usually, where a new conflict emerges and it affects the way the rest of the plot's going
to
go.
That's always got something to do with the, you know, the rookie. He's a little too hot. He's a little too hot tempered.
Yeah.
He's going to ruin everything.
So, okay. So I'm skipping ahead because this, what we're talking about actually goes with the clip I have.
Okay.
And it goes with Ocean's 11.
Oh,
so we're skipping ahead.
Matt Damon.
So basically, in this scene, George Clooney and Matt Damon are coming back to the hotel after they've gotten the pinch or whatever that's going to kind of basically shut down off Las Vegas for like 30 seconds or whatever. Damon and Clooney are back. Pitt meets up with them and they're coming to the hotel. And in the scene, they're told there's a problem that's going to affect the entire thing for them.
We have a problem. You've been red flagged. It means the moment you set foot in that casino floor, they'll be watching you, like hawks. Hawks with video cameras.
That's a problem.
Saul, turn that off, will you?
I'll turn it off when I'm ready to turn
Saul!
It off.
Saul!
It's off, it's off.
Any idea how this happened?
No.
Oh, come on. He's been chasing Benedict's girl. The two of them got in an argument 2 nights ago.
I was telling you.
And who told you to do that?
I did. I was concerned you couldn't leave Tess alone.
Who's Tess?
My wife.
Ex-wife.
Tess is here?
I'm sorry. I didn't know if it would sting you, but it did. You're out, Danny.
He's out?
It's either that or we call the whole thing off. His involvement puts us all at risk.
This is not your call.
Oh, you made it my call. When you put her before us, you made it mine.
This is my job.
Anymore.
Wait. He can't just be out. Who's gonna trigger the vault?
Kid, you up for it?
I can do it.
Done. Locate the others, let them know the change in plan. Curtain goes up at 7.
Tess is with Benedict now? She's too tall for him.
So good. That movie was
what
so good.
Freaking scene.
I know, right? Oh gosh.
To cut around the group, again, it's the same thing, right? You've got everybody in the room. You cut around for them for different reactions. It's an ensemble, but they've all got distinct things, right? It's incredible.
Textbook 101, guys. It's like, yeah. And every character has, you hear their personality and their voice,
yep.
And they have a distinct, like, reason to be in that room.
Yeah, even that last little kind of throwaway line of like, you know, Tess is with Benedict. She's too tall for him. Like, that's totally like, that's a very particular point of view in the reaction to that information, right? It's interesting. What were they, Brandon? You're the encyclopedia here. What were they watching on screen there?
Oh God.
Yeah.
Let me backtrack. What is Saul watching?
You've got this in your notes?
No, I'm watching the video now.
Oh my goodness, that's incredible. It's great when directors drop these things in, right? Because it's not just some random, you know, open source free clip. They've licensed something that they want to drop in.
So the clip, you only see like one shot of it.
Yeah,
but it's a character who's walking down a stairwell.
Yeah,
and for some reason it looks like it could be De Niro, but I'm not sure. Because you can't see the face.
Right.
So, I'm sorry,
I like
Ben.
I like the spin wipe too, or whatever, you know, at the transition. That's a pretty funny choice.
Yeah, this film has a lot of weird transitions that are not conventional nowadays. Like, I mean, you're not going to see like a star wipe. You might. I can't remember if you do in some of the later ones. But they have these weird transitions. But the thing about, because this, I picked this clip because I went through a lot of different clips in the film. But the pacing of this film is just so fast. Yeah. You really can't get a sense of just picking apart one scene and having that describe everything. And this is the one of the few times where like you have everyone in a room and they're going back and forth and you're getting all the distinct characters. Sometimes it's just Pitt and Clooney and it's like a minute scene, or it's the long scene where they're all together and Clooney's delving or giving the plan out of what's going to happen. Because every heist film with a team always has to have a scene where someone's laying out the plan of what they're going to do or what's going to happen or what they're going to steal. And I think Ocean's 11 is like textbook heist film. I think it does everything right. You have your montage of the people. Each character is very distinct. You need every single one of them. Everyone has their own role. It's visually pleasing. The sound is great. I just think everything about it works.
Yeah, for sure. Brandon, I'm looking over the Letterboxd list and dates released, which is something great. Everybody check out the Letterboxd list because you can look at it in a complete timeline and see exactly how this genre has changed. Something I think is really interesting that you didn't pick up in your notes, and I'm going to drop this on you, and it's going to, I don't think it's one you picked up on. But so we kind of got up to the 80s, start talking 90s, and heist films get really gritty again, I think, or like very serious, you know? You've got Usual Suspects, you've got Heat, you've got the first Mission Impossible, which is a spy movie, but is 100% a heist movie.
Yeah,
I mean, you got the famous, you know, they got to drop Tom Cruise in and he can't touch anything and his glasses are slipping and all that stuff. It's intense. But then you start getting in the late 90s, early 2000s, you get a blend of the heist movie and another genre that was very popular in the 90s that doesn't exist anymore. But I'm going to say this. You've got Out of Sight, Entrapment, Thomas Crown Affair, Gone in 60 Seconds. Somehow at the end of the 90s, early 2000s, the heist genre got mashed up with the erotic thriller.
Interesting.
And we got some very sexy heist movies. Because, I mean, nobody remembers what happened in Entrapment. The only thing Entrapment is known for is Catherine Zeta-Jones in a cat suit going through the lasers. I mean,
I watched the trailer for that right before we recorded, and I was like, I've seen that movie because Sean Connery and Catherine Zeta. And then, I saw the clips, and I was like, yeah, I've seen that movie.
That's exactly what it is. I mean, it's talking about Out of Sight, the chemistry is ridiculous in that movie. The scene in the trunk of the car is incredible. It's like palpable. And Thomas Crown Affair, the remake with Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo, it's interesting. This is the kind of stuff you see when you lay it all out in a timeline, and then everything tends to go a little bit more comedic from there. At that same time in England, you've got the rise of Guy Ritchie and Guy Ritchie like films with you've got Lock, Stock, Snatch, and then you've also got Sexy Beast, which I think is kind of like England's answer to Tarantino a little bit. But yeah, it's all interesting when you start to break down films like these to see the ways it changes.
Yeah, and you start getting and then after that in America, after the Sexy Beast and Snatch, you're getting the Ocean's 11, you're getting the Italian Job, you're getting National Treasure, which is a heist film. They're selling the Declaration of Independence. It's very, and then after that, you can still see where it becomes more serious again for a couple of years. And we're kind of skipping a couple decades. let's go back real quick. So the 70s, the 80s, what's some films we haven't talked about real quick? Because I want to jump into the 90s and 2000s. But you have a bunch of these realistic films like Dog Day Afternoon, which is, I think, it's an amazing film with Al Pacino, directed by Sidney Lumet. With Dog Day Afternoon and then Straight Time, some of these are starting to focus more on the realism of... thief like lifestyle or whatever. And like Dog Day Afternoon just has a, I know I read Lumet's book, Making Movies, and he talks about how he just told the actors to show up in whatever costumes they had, like their own clothes, because he wanted it to feel like there was no pattern. Mm. He just wanted it to feel as realistic as possible. So just wear your own stuff and we'll shoot the movie that way. He didn't want people to go through and develop a color palette because he wanted it to feel so natural. With Straight Time, you're getting Dustin Hoffman where he's gotten out of prison and he tries to get a job and he tries to be clean and something happens that basically is like, well, everyone sees me as a thief. I'm just going to start robbing people again. You're getting where it's in a way, it's kind of like the old West, the Western movies we're talking about in the late 60s, where all of these feel like time is catching up on them and they're going to get caught and say, might as well just keep going until they get caught. But yeah, so are there any films else we didn't talk about in that era?
No, I think we can move into the 90s for sure, because we have some interesting stuff we want to talk about in that genre, in that decade as well.
So we're talking about the resurgence of heist films in the late 90s, and Ben won't like this, but you could argue it kind of starts with Tarantino. You got Point Break in 91. You got Quick Change in 1990, which is a... I love Quick Change. Thomas, I hope you're on... Have you seen Quick Change, Thomas?
I have not.
Oh, Thomas, you're a Bill Murray aficionado. It's one of the... He directed this one. He co-directed this one. It's the only film he ever directed. And it's him, Gina Davis, and Randy Quaid. And it's amazing. It's very short. Ben, it's 89 minutes, so maybe you'll watch it sometime.
Now we're talking...
Basically, so Bill Murray, like, he robs a bank in a clown suit. That's what it, like, he that's the beginning of the movie. He robs a bank in a clown suit, and the easy part was robbing the bank. The hard part is getting out of Manhattan, and so the rest of the film is just them trying to get out of New York before they get caught. And so let's talk about the resurgence of heist films and just all the different styles and storylines. So what's some films that come to mind when we talk about like 1990s heist films?
Yeah, I mean, obviously like we were talking about before, the ones that really stick out are pretty self-serious. I mean, The Usual Suspects is huge in that era, and there's, you know, the famous Give Over the Keys scene is fun, but overall it's a pretty serious film. Heat is deadly serious, and a lot of people I think would classify Heat as one of the greatest heist films ever made. So they're definitely getting back to, you know, there's some quips in there maybe, but it's overall it's a pretty serious affair and a little bit more violent and a little bit more deadly.
I think it's fun too that we have Bottle Rocket on the list, right? And you've got some I mean, maybe it's a return to some of the 60s and 70s, right? But it's just the very comedic you know, wrapped up in a Wes Anderson package, but it's fun to see that mixed in. We're talking about super serious films, and then here's Bottle Rocket mixed in right there.
I think it's also interesting to see when looking at, say, the 90s or even a little bit before, where heist films are really good directorial debuts. If you notice it, even first or freshman or sophomore films. So you're looking at Bottle Rocket, which is Anderson's first film. Set It Off, which is a underrated heist film that I found at the video store. It's F. Gary Gray's second film after he made Friday, and Set It Off is basically it's J. Pinkett Smith, Queen Latifah, Vivica A. Fox, Kimberly Ellis, and it's an all-female heist film in L.A. Some people kind of compare it to what Widows became this past year. But you're also getting what was another one? Thief, which was Michael Mann in the 80s, is his first film, and it's a phenomenal debut. But the other one I want to talk about that we have a clip for is Dead Presidents. Well, also Reservoir Dogs is Tarantino's first film. But the one we want to talk about is Dead Presidents. And Thomas and I took a class on 90s cinema, and they showed Dead Presidents as one of the examples of that era. And Thomas, do you want to talk a little bit about this, and then we'll go into the clip?
Yeah, I think Dead Presidents is a very, very important film to look at in this genre, because not only does it introduce a you know, predominantly African-American cast for the first time, I think, in this entire genre, if you're going back in the timeline. But it is also the first time that it really introduces some very, very real social issues into the heist. It's still a heist movie, you know, but instead of, you know, these people that want money or aging Western, you know, aging cowboys or, you know, lifetime criminals or anything like this, it's talking about the experience of not just Vietnam veterans, but African-American Vietnam veterans coming back to America and not having a place in this country anymore, and just really feeling cast aside and hopeless, and so hopeless that they have to rob a bank. And it's still stylish, and it's still, I don't want to say fun, but it's still thrilling.
Yeah,
you know, they don't lose that part of the heist, but the stakes are a lot higher and the stakes are a lot more concrete.
Yeah. And so in the scene you have Lorraine, I don't know how to pronounce this
Lorenz Tate.
Lorenz Tate, okay, thank you. I apologize. Lorenz Tate, and he's playing Anthony, and Anthony, it's about the midpoint of the film. It's an interesting structured film. So you kind of have pre-war, you have a section of the war, and then about the hour or so mark is when he comes home from the war. So we're kind of in that area right now where he's come home from Vietnam, he's arrived, and he sees his old friend Skip, or Skippy, who's played by Chris Tucker. And so Chris Tucker in the scene is they're walking home and they're talking about their time.
Yeah, and Chris Tucker, who, like, you know, a lot of veterans during Vietnam had gotten hooked on heroin while he was in Vietnam and is struggling with that, has been back from the war for a while before Lorenz Tate has gotten back, and is kind of welcoming him back to see how the world has changed since Vietnam.
Man, the neighborhood is changing. No, it's still a good place. White people moving out, though. Oh, did? I saw Juanita the other day, man. Man, she finer than a motherfucker.
Is that right?
You need to go check her out, man. Go see your little daughter. Remember them big-ass ears you had when you was young? She got them. Just like you. That's how I know it's yours.
So what's up with Joe, man? Is he working or what?
Post office, you know. Three-quarter gig, part-time. You gotta do what you gotta do. We got miles for you, you know.
What about you, man? How you doing?
Who, me?
Yeah.
I'm cool, baby. I'm Skippy, baby. I'm still pimping.
Needing money or anything, you know?
Man, I got over like a fat rat when I got out, man. I got my school money coming from the government once a month. I got my veterans check coming once a month. I got my 50% medical check coming to me for the rest of my life. I ain't got to do a goddamn thing else but go to the mailbox, you dig?
Hey, man, how the hell you pull a 50% medical?
Nigga, you ain't disabled. Man, some shit got into me over there, man.
What?
All I know is my blood cells all fucked up. Some nights I wake up in cold sweats and shit. Don't look at me like that, man. It ain't the heroin. The heroin ain't never did nothing to me. A lot of vets come out with this shit.
And they don't know what it is.
Square beds.
Damn. Look, man, you want to come on in the crib or something, man?
I'm cool, baby. Hey, I'm a split. But you here, baby. You home. We got plenty of time to do our thing. You know what I'm saying?
Language warning.
Language warning. Too late. We'll put an E on this one, guys.
Ooh.
So, yeah. So Ben, have you ever seen Dead Presidents?
I haven't. I have not seen it.
So what are your thoughts on that scene? So it's just kind of like the only context you have is what we told you in that scene. Like, what's your...
Yeah, I mean, I didn't realize... I mean, it's made in 95, but I didn't know from the name or, you know, any of it that it was kind of set back... What would this be? Late 70s or mid 70s?
69 to 73 is where it takes place.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds like a fascinating film. I mean, it's not a clip that tells me... exactly about the heist, you know what I mean? But I think it's an interesting premise, like you're saying. I mean, you're basically, I mean, looking at the list, right, most of these films, I mean, this is a broad brush, but a lot of times the, you know, Ocean's 11, a lot of the big movies, they're robbing because it's like they're made for it. It's what they've always done. It's their last big heist. Like, you know, their motivations are just sort of in a way, kind of silly. Like, it's not...
Yeah.
Sometimes they raise the stakes and they have some real need for it, quote unquote. But, I mean, to anchor it in this way with, like, no, there's really... You know, there's really nothing here for me. Like you're saying, I've come back and I don't recognize the place where I live.
Yeah.
I feel like that's incorporated into more of the modern, you know, like when we move towards like 2000s and 2010s, right? I feel like there's a lot more of these films where it's like, no, this is a kind of fueled by necessity, or at least as they present it, you know, this necessity. They're out of options, basically, like you're saying. Like, they feel trapped, and so it's not because they're, like, pros. I mean, a film that we talked about before we started recording is, like, Place Beyond the Pines, right? Mm-hmm. Which isn't on the list. It's not really a heist movie, but he's a bank robber, right? I mean, a portion of the story is about him robbing banks, and, you know, does he need to do it? I don't know exactly, but, you know, he's not necessarily... jumping into it because he's this pro. He's like, the first time they show the robbery is him on the dirt bike, and he's kind of like punching himself and trying to get his helmet off, and like there's all these kind of like goofy bits, well, not goofy, but he's inexperienced, you know. It's not that he's George Clooney walking in sly. It's that he's trying to kind of take care of what he needs to take care of, and he doesn't see too many other options.
Yeah, and I think Dead Presidents is an important movie to look at because it does kind of pave the way for more modern films that there's a lot of, when you start thinking about it, there's a good deal of modern films like Place Beyond the Pines that kind of take the modern economy and the last recession into account when talking about these heists. Killing Them Softly is a huge one that like makes a lot of like open comparisons between like what's going on in the country and the fact that these people have to steal. Inside Man is a very slick movie, but has a lot, you know, it's still Spike Lee film. It has some social issues to it. And then like more modern ones, I think Hell or High Water is a huge one that is a heist movie, but it's got all this built-in weight of what's happening in America right now. Even Widows, you know, takes into account, you know, as females, what position these women are put into, as wives, and how they're able to work with that to their advantage sometimes. So I think Dead Presidents is really a good one to look at as starting to pave the way for people to go, you know, these can still be fun and exciting, but you can give them some real world stakes and some real world basis.
Yeah, and I'll say this too. I think it might honestly have to do with them both being African American stories told by African American directors. So, Dead Presidents is by the Hughes brothers, who'd made Menace to Society before this. Set It Off is F. Gary Gray, who made Friday before this. And like Dead Presidents and Set It Off, what it is that Vivica A. Fox gets fired from her job because she works at a bank and there's a robbery. This is the opening of the movie. There's a robbery and she's fired because the cops go, well, you live in the same neighborhood as them. You must know who they are, and you must have been involved. They fire her. She gets upset. Jada Pinkett Smith has a tragedy that happens in her life where she gets upset and decides to join them. And then Kimberly Ellis basically needs money to make sure she can keep her kid because the child services are have taken her kid away from her, and she needs to make money to get her kid back. So all of them have these very, pretty much, besides Meg Queen Latifah, who has a great role in the film, has a solid reason of why they need to rob. Or it's they're living in the projects and they want to get out, and they feel like that life has thrown them so many just terrible situations, they want to get out of it. And honestly, with some of these other ones, I'll bring race into it. Like, you have Bling Ring, where it's just like, it's white girls who are robbing just to rob.
Yeah.
And I think that comes from who's telling the story, what their experiences are, and what they're trying to say.
Yeah, there's an angle of these films, right, that are just kind of fun, right?
Yeah.
It's all like, oh, we, like, you know, we might, like, knock out a guard or kill the cameras or whatever. And there's not a lot of... I mean, and there are dark and gritty ones, but there's definitely a subsection within this that, like you're saying, it is, it's not necessarily just race, but it's an economic distinction where it's like, I mean, Clooney and Pitt and all these, you know, whenever they get dropped into a lot of these movies, they're just kind of rich dudes rolling around, you know, bored in a way. Like it, with Brad Pitt's performance, we were talking about it. Like it's an incredible performance because he's just walking around eating food the whole time, just like happy to be there, basically. And that's not a person who's, you know, struggling in society, basically. This is just this character that we want to see on the screen, but we can't really relate to, I mean, well, day to day.
Ben, that you're talking about, like, knocking a guard out or something, I think brings us to a film that Brandon and I both really want to talk about, is last year's American Animals. Because it takes all of that into account, this idea of like white men who are just doing this for the fun of it. That's literally what this is about. And it's really interestingly done film because it's based on a true story and it contains documentary elements. They are interviewing the real people who did this heist as we're watching the heist happen in film. And it's really interesting because they do dive into it. It is a fun heist movie that is styled like Ocean's 11, but constantly dealing with the fact that these are four, you know, suburban, wealthy enough white males who just wanted to pull a heist off to see if they could do it. Yeah. And who did end up hurting people. And you know, there's even a point where they talk about the real people talk about it on camera. They just got caught up in all of this and didn't even realize that they were causing real pain to real people. And, I know Brandon has some stuff stylistically too to talk about American Annals, but I think it's kind of interesting as the ultimate postmodern heist film because it brings together all these stylistic choices of the films we've been talking about along with the stakes of these more recent movies, starting with Dead Presidents and continuing on from there.
Yeah, American Animals is one of those films, those few heist films that is aware it's in a heist movie. Because it's essentially a docudrama in a way. Mm-hmm. And so by that, I mean, stylistically, so and there's a scene in the movie where they talk about how there's no books on how to pull off a heist. So they just watch a bunch of movies. Mm. So you're seeing them watch The Killing by Stanley Kubrick, which is one of his earlier films, where it's a really gritty heist film in the 60s. Or they have like, I think they even had The Sting. They had a bunch of movies like from Blockbuster because of the time period where the movie takes place in. Where you just have them lined up and going through them. And then even stylistically in the way it's shot, they use actually shots from other films. They have a shot where one of the guys is getting picked up for the heist, and it's the exact same shot of when the Joker gets picked up from the Dark Knight for the opening heist. Or when they're doing their kind of their fantasy sequence of how the heist is going to go down, they're playing A Little Less Conversation by Elvis, which is very prominent in Ocean's 11. And so it's very aware of the history of the genre, and it's putting it in part in the visual narrative of the overall story. So it's very aware of what it is.
And boom, we just hit last year. We've gone all the way from the beginning of modern cinema to last year.
To 2018.
And the way that everything has balled together, and that's what this show is all about.
And so the interesting two stats I found out that I thought was were intriguing. From to go with this resurgence of the heist film, from 1995 to 2018, there has been a heist film, at least one heist film every year, except in the years 2005 and 2014. There has been at least one heist film. And then the record for most heist films in the year that I can find was actually last year, where it had 8 heist films in 1 year. So I don't know what that's saying about the culture right now. But you had Hurricane Heist, Mission Impossible Fallout, Solo, which is it's a heist film because they have moments when they're stealing things and they're planning out a heist.
Yeah, I mean, the plot is based around it.
Yeah. Den of Thieves, American Animals, Ocean's 8, Widows, and The Old Man and the Gun, which I want to briefly talk about. So I think the two greatest cinema thieves of all time are Robert Redford and George Clooney, just based on the amount of films they have done where they're playing a thief.
Are you calculating this by like total earnings, like that they have hypothetically gained in each film?
We're talking quality.
I'm talking quality.
That would be a great thing to break down, though.
But so, I want to see a chart of like total earnings from hypothetical robberies in films.
So that'd be, that actually is pretty good. But okay, so Clooney has been in Three Kings. He's been in Ocean's 11, 12, and 13. He's been Out of Sight. He's been Welcome to Collinwood, which is a very small indie film that's a heist film that starts Clooney's in like a cameo part, but Sam Rockwell, who's the lead guy in it. There was another one Clooney when I thought. So that's six, right? We got six Clooney. With Redford, you have Butch Cassidy, you have The Hot Rock, you have The Sting, you have Sneakers, and you have Old Man the Gun. And with Old Man the Gun, what I wanted to bring up real quick is that Old Man the Gun is really a tribute film to Redford's career as a thief. Because one, and I realized I was watching on the plane while I was coming back recently to L.A., and there's a moment where I really understood it, where in The Sting, they have the whole thing where like they swipe the nose or whatever. Do you know what I'm talking about? Yep. Where it's like the like, is it their signal to do it, or it's just kind of like the thing that Newman and Redford do?
Yeah, everyone on the whole team is in on it. It's just like the plan. It's going according to plan. Boom! I just did my part. It's on to you now. Yeah.
And they swipe the nose. And so what happens in Old Man the Gun, which I caught, was at one point, at the very end, it's kind of a spoiler, but Redford's in the hospital and Casey Affleck, who's the officer who's been kind of tracking him down, comes up to him, doesn't say anything, passes him something, and then does his nose like that and then walks out of the room. And I was like, oh, this is just a tribute film to like Redford's career. And that's why it's a good fitting in to if he decides to retire, which is what he's saying he is. I think it's a wonderful curtain call, I guess you could say, for Redford.
I've got a little trivia bit too for that film. Was I had like an afternoon a couple months back when it was in theaters, and I was like, oh, I'll just go slide in. I'll roll in like 10 minutes before. I could not get a ticket because so many. I almost got run over by old people in the parking lot. Seriously, they were like in herds going to see this film, and I was like, wait a minute, what? It's like 2:35 or whatever. You know, I had like time.
It's Redford, baby.
Sold out. Couldn't get a ticket.
Yeah, man.
Sold out. I was like, man, I thought I was just going to roll in and see something that, you know, isn't going to do big numbers. No.
It's a fun film. But yeah, if you like Redford, if you like his career as a thief, it's one to watch. All right. So any films we didn't talk about?
Well, I have one thing I want to summarize real quick.
Yeah.
Just looking back at all these movies, I've realized something. My favorite thing about a heist film is the twist that you think they didn't make it, and they did. Ocean's 11, The Sting, Logan Lucky. What else are we looking at? What else are we looking at? I know those are even Ocean's like 12.
You can even argue Hell or High Water.
Hell or High Water. Inside Man. You know this idea that there's this moment where it's like, oh, we got beat, and then you go, wait, flashback, boom, this is the reason why we did all this, and you, the audience, have been fooled the whole time. And the one thing I just want to point out is the reason I think Ocean's 11, the original, does not work is that it does the exact opposite. It makes the audience think that they've won, and then the twist is that they have not.
They have not, and
that's just not what we're here for. We're either here to see it all go wrong, or to see it all go right. But we're not here to be made to think that it all went right and then watch it fall apart.
Yeah,
that's no fun.
And Ocean's that original one, I think Ocean's 11 is probably the greatest remake or one of the greatest remakes of all time. I won't say the greatest, but it's one of the greatest remakes of all time because I just don't really like the first one all. Some people love it, but it's like you're saying, it has some good characters, but then like it's one of the worst endings I've ever seen in a film to me. Oh. Like I go, oh wait, Ben, you haven't seen it, so I don't want to. If you ever do watch it, just know the ending infuriated me when I watched it, and I was very happy that Soderbergh they saw the flaws of the film and were able to bring it up to a modern context and change. And that's the best kind of remake, where they can see what went wrong with the previous one, update it to a modern context.
Yeah. I mean, that's the sales pitch of doing a remake, is to make it better.
Yeah.
And speaking of pitches.
Yeah. Hit me with it. Bring the heat.
So who's first? You won last time.
I won last time. I'll let you go first, Brandon.
Oh, no. Okay. All right.
Bring the energy here, Brandon. Well, let's do it.
Let me start stretching. Okay. Okay. So the movie I am pitching to you, Mr. Ben Gertz,
yeah,
is the 1992 comedy caper underrated gem, Sneakers. And Sneakers stars the greatest thief of all time, Robert Redford. And the cast after that is just kind of crazy. I always wonder, how did they get these guys together? You got Dan Aykroyd. You got River Phoenix right after My Own Private Idaho. It's one of his last films, too. Sidney Poitier as Redford's right-hand guy, but don't iconic. Take the... Iconic. I mean, he's phenomenal. He's the right-hand guy, but he's just as important as Redford. Everyone has a part in this. David Strathern, who is a phenomenal character actor, and Mary McDonnell. And then you also got Ben Kingsley as essentially the antagonist of the movie. Redford's this old... He in the 60s, he was kind of this... It was an early hacker. It's kind of hacking into certain things at the beginning and kind of using conservative funds from, like, Nixon and stuff and putting it into, like, liberal causes like the Black Panther Party and everything. Something happens. He has to go underground and he changes his whole identity. Flash forward, present day. His name is Martin Bishop now. And Redford has his whole team of heist guys. You start right at the beginning of a heist where they're robbing a bank. And what you find out is that this team of guys, these security specialists, are actually, they're robbing the bank to prove to the bank what the flaws of the bank are. That was a weird sentence. But they're basically trying to find the flaws of the bank to where the bank can protect themselves from ever getting robbed. That's their job.
But hold on, sorry. This is they are paid by the bank to do this, or
yes,
because this is a hacker thing, right? Is you have white hats and black hats, and so you they actually call it penetration testing, which is, you know, whatever. But you're basically paid by the corporation to, like,
yes,
hack the corporation, mm-hmm, to then turn, yeah, around and say, here's how we did it.
Yes.
Anyway, yeah.
And so, but they're doing it in more like old fashioned, like bank robbery.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so you're, gotcha, not aware of that in the opening scene of what they're doing. And so there's a scene where he gets the money from the attendant at the bank, and she's like, this is what you do? He's like, yeah. She goes, that's a weird way to make a living. Like, it's not like a glorious job.
Yeah.
And so Martin Bishop, Redford's character, gets visited from these NSA officers, and they tell the team, or they tell Redford, hey, we need you to steal this black box from this mathematician. And basically what they don't really say what it is, but they begin to find out that it's kind of a code breaker. And so the rest of the team doesn't want to do it because they could wind up dead or something could happen. But the NSA basically reveals to Martin they have all their secrets about them, including him, who no one knows he exists until now. And so it's like, if you don't do this for us, we're going to turn you in and get you arrested. They take the black box. They wind up getting the black box, and they end up finding out what it is. They realize they're in way over their heads. Like, they're just these kind of small time kind of crooks in a way. Even though they're getting hired by companies, they're still like, Sidney Poitier is this old CIA agent who they don't know why he got out of CIA, and some of them had jail time, and so they have to figure out a way to get this box into the right hands, because they think these NSA guys might not be exactly what they seem to be.
Ooh.
So in this scene, I'm going to show you a
clip.
Saying
a heist movie might not be as it seems.
Ooh, yeah. They've gone too far into it, and they're just like, oh, shit.
It's a good thing we put an E on this.
So in this scene, so at one point, Redford has been actually was captured by these possible NSA officers and taken to meet with Ben Kingsley, who's essentially the kind of the villain of the movie, but he's a former friend of Redford earlier on.
Hmm.
That's kind of a little bit of a spoiler, but it's okay. It's more about their relationship and how they interact, guys. So he's been kidnapped. He's taken to Ben Kingsley. He doesn't know where it's at, and they're the ones that have the box. So in this scene, all of the guys are kind of in hiding, and they're staying at Mary McDonald's apartment, who is kind of Redford's girlfriend. And they've just talked to a government agency that could help them, but they're kind of just trapped. They don't know what to do. They don't know where the box is. They can only get out of the situation unless they find the box. So in this scene, they're all kind of backtracking where Redford might have been taken.
There's got to be a way to cut a deal with those guys.
Too late. If we had the box, yes. Without it, no.
So let's get this frickin' thing.
I don't know where it is, remember?
What did it sound like?
You have no idea at all where they took you.
No.
They threw me in a trunk, drove around in circles. It could be 100 miles away. It could be next door. It could be underground. It could be in a skyrise. Forget it.
Fish, what did it sound like?
What?
The road. When you were in the trunk, what did the road sound like?
Well, I don't know. Highway, a regular highway.
Well, did you go over any speed bumps? Gravel? How about a bridge?
Bridge?
Yeah.
Four bridges in the Bay Area.
Was the Golden Gate fogged in last night?
Yes.
Did you hear a foghorn?
No. Scratch the Golden Gate. That leaves three.
What did it sound like? Did you go through a tunnel in the middle?
I'm not... No. Scratch the bay.
Well, that leaves two. San Mateo and Dumbarton.
What did it sound like?
Lower. Lower. There was a recurring sound.
Like seams in the concrete.
But further apart.
Okay.
So I didn't preface this earlier before the scene. David Strathairn is blind.
Yeah.
And that's the way he's asking, like, what did you hear? He's trying to figure out, because that's kind of his character throughout. Is like he's their audio guy. He's their audio guy. Aykroyd's their visual guy. River Phoenix is their researcher. Poitier is kind of their like more intelligence tech guy. And Redford's just the boss. And so Strathairn's very big on sound. So there's a lot of times where he's asking them to listen to what's going on to find the clue. And so that's very apparent throughout.
What an interesting, role. And also, I'm trying to think of another film. That's such an interesting thing because it's so, fits so well with a film, right? You wouldn't put that in a book of like, and then they went to the keyboard, and the sound synthesizer started making noises. Right? It's not visual per se, but it's
great cinematic.
Scene. It's cinematic. Yeah, yeah. There's tension in it. There's tension, even though it's not purely visual. You're kind of on the edge of your seat with Redford as he's hunting for those sounds. That's really cool.
Yeah, and you're seeing these kind of really long shots as well. And that scene, you're seeing the team work together and. Mm-hmm. To prep for this film, I also watched the film and then the commentary. So I watched this film twice. And that was a scene where literally, because it was both the two writers and the director, Phil Alden Robinson, who was the director of Field of Dreams, just throwing it out there. And they're talking and they just kind of stop and watch the scene. And they're just like, what's so great is that they're creating a plan. But they don't have to say, hey, let's think this through. It's just their natural chemistry as actors and as characters. They just jump in to realize, okay, we're doing this. Let's figure this out. They don't have to state it. And that's very apparent. It's a movie where like I wish there was either, and I know Thomas will say this probably with his as well, I wish there was a sequel to, or like they reboot. This is one I would like to reboot in some way. And they've tried to do a TV show, because just if you get the characters right, if you get the cast right, it doesn't really matter what they're stealing. Like we've talked about before, it matters just how good they are together. And that's present throughout. I think it's an underrated, underseen gem. Probably Redford's, I think, underrated thief movie that kind of hopefully will get discovered, because a lot of people I know that like go to the video store or whatever, find it and then end up watching it over and over again. It's just one that I think you can watch a lot because of how great they all are together.
It was one I was lucky enough to find in the dawn of DVDs in like a Walmart, and my parents were like, oh yeah, I remember that movie, and picked it up, and I watched it like religiously for like a year or so. It was one of the only DVDs I had, and it would like, I'd plug it in.
You're hurting your pitch, Thomas. You've already like...
Ooh. Oh, no, I'm not hurting my pitch.
Confidence.
Confidence.
All right.
So much
confidence. Well, that's my pitch, so...
That's great.
I'm out.
Brandon, is it streaming anywhere? Is it streaming anywhere?
Ben, I'm pitching it. Why would it be?
I feel like you need to just go ahead and preface all of your pitches with, and this pitch is brought to you by the video store in Los Angeles.
Give me a second
to pick up the one copy.
I mean, let's be real. You can find anything online. Rent it in HD on Amazon for $3.99.
That's not bad.
Help the filmmakers out.
Okay, Ben, here we go. Yeah,
here we go.
I take you back to 2015.
Ooh.
A time when Alicia Vikander has not yet won an Academy Award. Henry Cavill has only made one Superman movie, and long before Henry Cavill has reloaded his arms in Mission Impossible. And a time when most critics have declared that Armie Hammer's career is dead. And we have The Man from U.N.C.L.E. by Guy Ritchie. You know, Guy Ritchie, the pedigree of heist films. Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, Snatch, making a movie based on a very popular TV show from the 60s, one of my mom's favorite TV shows of all time. Just got to throw that out there. But this film is insanely stylish. It is gorgeously shot. I mean, it is. I've seen it several times now. The costumes are amazing. The sets are amazing. Everyone in the movie is ridiculously good looking. There is no one in this movie that is not good looking. And it's just fun. It's fun. And it went very underappreciated when it came out, I think, because no one had the appreciation for these actors that they do now. So you have Henry Cavill starring as Napoleon Solo, who is a art thief turned CIA agent. He was kind of like Robert Redford in Sneakers. He was caught and threatened with jail time if he didn't become a CIA agent. And he has been given the mission of retrieving Alicia Vikander from behind the Iron Curtain. We're in the 60s Cold War. And she is a German woman caught behind the Iron Curtain whose father is a former Nazi nuclear engineer. And the Americans want her to help them track him down and stop him from selling a nuclear bomb to anyone who's not an American. Armie Hammer is playing Ilya Kuryakin, who is the top KGB agent in Russia, and he has also been tasked with tracking this scientist down and stopping him from selling the nuclear bomb. And so the CIA and the KGB decide that they will team up because neither of them want a nuclear bomb. You know, they both want all the nuclear bombs. They don't want anybody else to have them.
Right.
So even though Napoleon Solo and Kuryakin have had run-ins in the past as enemy agents, they're now being forced to work together to basically break into this Italian crime family who is holding this scientist hostage and steal both the scientist and his nuclear bomb plans from this Italian family. The head of the Italian crime family is played wonderfully by Elizabeth Debicki, who is an extremely underrated actress. Yeah, so this is just a ridiculously fun movie. And when you go back and watch this movie, knowing what you know now about this cast, it is insane that they had this cast together and they let them go. Henry Cavill and Armie Hammer are both people who I think have been criminally underused or criminally wrongfully used by Hollywood. Armie Hammer, everyone tried. I mean, he's huge. He's a super tall guy, extremely good looking. And everyone tried to make him, you know, your leading man. And he's a good leading man, but he's not a white knight. He's not the Lone Ranger. He's kind of an asshole, and he's great as that, and that's what Call Me By Your Name ended up finding. You know, the whole kind of his whole character is built around how obnoxious he is at first. And Henry Cavill is not Superman. I think everyone can say that the DC Universe's take on Superman right now wasn't great. And in this movie, he's very dry and very witty and just your ideal secret agent. and Alicia Vikander is wonderful as always. And what really makes this movie work is the chemistry between the three of them, which is why Brandon, I think. Mm-hmm. Wait, which one are we showing? I sent you two.
Oh, the safe one.
Oh, we're showing the safe one. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. I'll pivot. Anyway, the team is wonderful.
Safe one. Okay.
We had to. It's about a safe. We had to pick one. We had to pick one that did not have Alicia Vikander in it, just because a lot of the scenes that she's in are too long, and we were just looking for a quick, quippy dialogue scene to show the chemistry between between the whole team. But I guess we'll just show between Henry Cavill and Armie Hammer in this scene where they are breaking into a safe, which they think will show them where the scientist is being held, or exactly what's going on with this Italian crime family.
Want to have a go? Be my guest. Hold this. And these. Open these. This is a Swiss-built Wartbinder Landsman 7010 model. It has dual combination locks, triple return rotators, and synchronized cylinders. The earlier models had a design flaw. It's a flaw I intend to exploit. Still, very difficult to open, but it's not impossible. And the flaw was, people who designed this model are not very good at stealing things. I, however, am.
Did you deactivate alarm?
Model 7010 doesn't have an alarm.
Loving your work, cowboy.
You leave me wanting more, Thomas. That's good.
It's a good time. It's a good time. The action scenes are shot wonderfully. It's, you know, it's Guy Ritchie. He's got a great style when he wants to. And it's something I texted Brandon last night after I rewatched it. I think even though it is very stylish and all centered around this heist, I think it boils down to a caper. It doesn't feel like it, because the action is handled so well, but a lot of the times, even when the action is happening, the film is prioritizing the chemistry between the three of them and the relationships between the three of them over the action. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of times you have these action scenes that are done in really unique ways in order to build the humor and build the characters. It's essentially, like I said, my favorite part of a heist movie is building the team, and this movie is essentially a building the team movie. It's about the three of them learning to get along and to work well together, and it ends with them officially becoming a team with Hugh Grant as their handler. And then, and that, there's, oh man, can you imagine being the studio executive now, looking back and realizing you let that cast slip through your fingers for a sequel? Like, it's travesty. But the film is very fun. The cast is incredible. It's all people who have come into their own in the past, you know, 4 years since this movie happened. And it's a great spy movie, and it's a great heist movie, and I highly recommend it.
Gentlemen.
Decision time.
He is the decider.
Yeah, where's my theme music? We still haven't decided on that. I think I'm going to... How much do I build you up to set you down gently? I'm going to go ahead and just tell you. I'm going with Brandon on this one.
Woo!
No!
Yep, I'm going with Brandon on this one. I can tell you why. And Thomas, I'm going to tell you that there were some clues laid out for you from the beginning, right? Yeah. Which is, if you go on Letterboxd, you can see I'm not a big Guy Ritchie person. And you actually even said it during the episode. Guy Ritchie is sort of the Tarantino of Britain, right? Wasn't it you?
Oh, I take that back. This is not like those other ones, Ben. This is much more mainstream. This is much less Tarantino-esque than that other stuff.
I will say this. The style of that clip you showed, and I can appreciate Guy Ritchie's style. Like, he has a visual flair that is like very, you know, iconic. Basically, he does a lot of really interesting things, but
I do have to pitch real quick. I accept your decision, but I do have to say, for the sake of checking this out, I've seen a lot of car chases in my time. There is a bird's eye view car chase that is exceptionally well done in this. You know, it is, when you're watching it, you're like, this does not feel like anything I've seen in a car chase before. I'm just saying.
I expect some wow from him, right? That's the whole, he's going to do something visually interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you that, the clip with, David, Strathern, how do you say his name?
Yeah. Strathern or something. Yeah.
Strathern, from Sneakers. That's interesting to me. Just as a premise is like, I mean, what are some other, there's not many, there are obviously films with blind characters. You've got Contact has that famous scene, right, where they're sitting there listening to the sounds from the transmissions, right, and they're going, there's something here, it's rhythmic, you know. I think that's just an interesting, I mean, it can be overused. Contact doesn't really, you don't need that really, you know, but it's cool. But I like, obviously, the cast, like you're saying, the cast of both films, you guys have honed in on the importance of casting. I will, here's a hesitation for me on yours, Brandon, is the hacking part, right? I think I was talking about this the other day with someone, and it's like, the depictions of hacking in films are just always bad. There's just almost never a good, like, and it's, you know, it's because you're basically writing, you know, you're just sitting in front of a computer basically. But anyway, I'm curious to see how this plays out. I hope you feel happy for yourself, Brandon, because you went on a little bit of a ledge going into the 90s. Like, you know, it's not retro enough to be hip.
Yeah.
But I'm there. I'm giving it to you. I'm giving you the W. Thomas, come back and do your homework.
I shouldn't have trusted Brandon to pick between the two clips that
I sent. Oh, God. Well, like, one was a 2-minute clip, one was a 3-minute clip. I'm like,
I knew I should have believed in Elise, in the power of Alicia Vikander.
That probably could have swung things, honestly.
And you know, I let Brandon, you know, talk me into brevity, but
okay. Well, here's the thing. I believe I chose your clip last time, Thomas. If you want to be real, you gave me different ones.
That's true. Brandon also. Brandon nixed my clip last time because it had too much profanity in it, and then turns around and shows.
And I gave you a better clip that won you the round. So calm down. This is making up for it.
Guys, let's keep the rivalry alive.
And just so you know,
are we tied again?
Huh?
Are we tied again?
I'm up one.
I think we're tied again.
Oof.
What?
I thought I went up one last week.
We're going to have to crowdsource this. People are going to have to tweet in and let us know who's winning.
let's do this. Okay, so one. I'm like counting it up.
Do it right
now.
How many
we've done it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Let's do it live.
No, this is our seventh episode. So I am up one.
Okay, all right. Well, now I know. No Guy Ritchie pitches.
Unless you can give me a clip with
with Alyssa Vikander.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, that was a fun episode. It was a long episode. Yep. We'll hope you guys enjoy it. Make sure you send us your comments. Give us a review. Give us a rating on iTunes. You can find us on iTunes and Spotify, depending on where you download. Follow us on Facebook. Follow us on our Twitter at Cinenation Show. We like to hear from you guys. I'm hearing from a couple people at the video store when they rent the movies we're talking about. That's actually currently happening. I try to do my shelf based on what podcasts we're doing or coming out. So, but guys, hopefully you send us your thoughts on the things we've talked about. Give us some maybe ones we missed, and send up some stuff you might want us to talk about in future episodes. So
Ben, subgenres. Tell us what you want.
Ben Thomas, thank you always for joining me with this.
Yeah, for sure.
And listeners, thank you so much for listening. I hope you listen to more episodes soon. Bye.